Thank you, Gary. So I'd like to introduce these four gentlemen. I see Mark Rabinowitz and Brian Brooks and Eric Cohn and Eugene Hernandez. Come on down, guys. So thank you for being here. Since this is an intimate gathering,
Cheers.
We brought our drink.
Essential.
Did everybody else bring a drink?
Yeah. But since this is an intimate gathering, you know, rather than perhaps even waiting till the end for you guys to ask questions, feel free and like raise your hand while we're talking if you have something you'd like to say, and then I'll do a formal, more formal Q&A toward the end. So, gentlemen, there was this moment from the late 80s to probably the late 90s, and filmmakers like Quentin Tarantino and Steven Soderbergh and Todd Solondz and Kelly Reichardt and Todd Haynes and so many others were emerging, Richard Linklater, and it was an exciting and passionate and fervent moment for the independent film world. That world didn't have a voice other than through the filmmakers themselves. And suddenly something started happening that came out of conversations and knowledge and college buddies and all of this. So let's talk about the origin story of IndieWire, because it's valuable and important and we want to know. So Mark.
It's funny because the person who vividly remembers the actual moment is a guy named Tim LaTorre, who was one of our early compatriots. And I went to Sundance with my mother, whose film we showed earlier today.
And
Who was your mom? Well, my mom, Joanne Grant, and then film.
Who was your mom with? Because that's relevant. Yeah.
Right.
We went with
my mother's cinematographer by the name of Judy Irola, who had a film at Sundance that year, and she said, "Do you guys want to come to Sundance? I got a film in competition." And we went, "Yeah, sure, why not?" I wanted to be in the film business. I didn't know anybody in the film business, so we went. And I was on a shuttle bus, and I met Tim. And Tim's like, "Oh, this is, you know, cool. I've never been here either. You should meet my friend Eugene that I'm here with." And we met, and literally that was just sort of like, oh, and Eugene was actually supposed to leave like the next day, or you were supposed to leave actually that day, the day before, and they had actually decided to extend his trip. So
just to meet you.
he had this premonition. But no, but if that, and if this, and if there's all these little bits of happenstance that had to sort of fall into place for all of this to happen, and that was, you know, it's like a butterfly flapped its wings, and I met Eugene at Sundance.
So, Eugene, there was this platform called AOL, I think that was the name of it back then. They sent out discs to everyone 7 times a week. AOL had something to do with this, the nascent part of this experience. Well, I guess before that, it was actually email, another, you know, technology. But tell us a little bit about what you imagined.
We met at Sundance, as Mark mentioned, and it was a group of us who that year at Sundance bonded with a number of other filmmakers. It was the year of the 20-something at Sundance, 1993. So you had filmmakers like Robert Rodriguez, Brian Singer, Mark will remember more of the filmmakers who were there. Jennifer Lynch had a film, Rob Weiss. A number of younger filmmakers, and I think before we embarked upon pursuing IndieWire, it grew out of this kind of communal relationship, this kind of community kind of vibe that grew among a number of younger people who were there that year. So into that first year of 93 and then going into Sundance 94, we just became friends with a bunch of filmmakers who were kind of all at the same level of both interest and kind of newness to the industry or the community as we were. And the idea for IndieWire kind of grew out of these conversations we started having and this notion that you would go to Sundance, 93, and then you go back home to wherever you lived. Mark lived in New York, I lived in LA, Tim lived in LA, other people went to other cities, you know, and that was it. You didn't really stay in touch with folks easily, call them on the phone, but Email was still kind of a new thing, right? And so the idea was really to create kind of an online community for all these different filmmakers. And we would go back to Sundance the next year. You meet the same people, meet new people. The network kind of expands. And so we started on AOL by producing these online chats. There was a kind of a online community called iLine that was the predecessor to IndieWire. And it was just the notion that we could kind of stay connected.
I mean, for those of you that don't know what AOL was like, Eugene actually, what you could do is you could search among all of AOL's members for their interests. So you could search for film, independent film, and you could search for, you know, Herzog and Fassbender and people who had that interest, their profile would pop up.
Yeah, it was not unlike Facebook now.
You could then email them, and as a group, so Eugene put together this email, and he emailed all these people and said, once a week we're going to go into a chat room and just talk about indie film. And that's how we met some of the people that became our earliest writers. And from there, Eugene talked to his people at ABC Online, and we got like a little chat room, and we did a chat with Nicole Holofcener and Brian Singer and John Cryer, and Kevin Smith, in 2004 to 2005. I mean, 94 to 95, and it just sort of rolled on from there.
Yeah.
I think what's lost sort of in the history of the site is what you guys were doing there, which was not trying initially to create a business, but just a direct reaction to a deficiency, which was people having a place to talk about independent film. Because when you go to a film festival, it's so insular. And then you leave and it's not there. Mm-hmm. What you guys were doing was just saying, why does that have to stop? And that was the first time, really, where you could see it. I mean, yeah, the dial-up modems were really loud, and the chat rooms were kind of slow, and everyone was saying age, sex, tech, and all that kind of stuff. But you were like, hey, maybe there's a way for us to be constructive with this. And there were only a handful of people really doing it at that time. So I think, in a broader sense, IndieWire was pioneering something about the community that the internet can be, beyond, the entertainment possibilities.
Yeah. And that's interesting, Eric, because I think this idea of community and community building and community organizing and the independent film world, it was kind of a perfect synergistic moment to make that happen. I think America was first becoming aware of indie film at that moment, Soderbergh in 89 with Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and suddenly all these really exciting voices started emerging. And other than the screen, there was no way to gather and share and exchange dialogue. And that's why this is such a valuable and at that time nascent way of being part of a community, whether you're a filmmaker or just a passionate person who loves indie film.
Well, and we were all very passionate about independent film, and Brian and I went to college together, and he got involved very early on as well, and we just, the kinds of movies that we were seeing at festivals or the kinds of movies that were being released in the art house theaters in LA at that time or New York were the kinds of movies that we were going to, and the alternative voices, the sort of outside of the mainstream kind of stories, and the kind of diverse, the openness to diverse range of stories and films and filmmakers were, I think, what provoked all of us and kind of drove all of us to find each other, either at Sundance, like we did, as Mark mentioned, or very shortly after. I remember, and Mark has a much better memory than I do for all of this stuff, because I just forget everything. But I remember being in New York in the first couple of years of starting iLine and then IndieWire. And we also were connecting with a lot of folks who, at that moment in the industry, were also at the very beginning of their career. I remember we had coffee with Anthony Bregman and Mary Jane Skalski, people who were, at that point, the kind of underlings at Good Machine, the company, the very important production company in New York that was producing films by Ang Lee and Hal Hartley, a bunch of others. But I feel like there was just this hunger and interest among a bunch of people of a similar generation who didn't feel like the mainstream movies of that moment, while we might have gone to see them, they weren't really speaking to us kind of in terms of what we wanted to do. And we saw in the other people that we were meeting similar interests, and there was no real way to kind of organize ourselves. So it always had that kind of community component to it.
And certainly the trades weren't covering any of these other things that the work that these people were doing.
So publications like Variety and the Hollywood Reporter and Screen International, first of all, none of them had an online presence really at that time, and none of them cared about
online. Ew.
Exactly.
It was like the noses went up.
They were print publications and proud of their journalistic heritage and their connection to the studio system.
Well, we showed them.
I mean, if I can, and I don't know if Eugene... This is an interesting story because there was one time, online you could, even with AOL, and even though we did have dial-up a lot of times, there were many times I can tell you that I was at a festival early on and when I started and we would, and then I would try and upload a photo and then the whole thing would crash. I have to start reloading it again. But anyway, I digress. But there was an interesting, I think, moment that a trade had because we had gotten a bit of a scoop, and because they didn't have an online presence, IndieWire had the potential to upload this, to break this major news story.
Well, it was interesting because, as an example, Miguel Arteta, the filmmaker, and then he ultimately worked television as well, had a film at Sundance called Star Maps. And this story kind of very, very nicely kind of shows you kind of the composition of IndieWire and our approach at the time. We were covering the festival, and Jeremy Walker, who was a publicist at the time, reached out to us in advance of the film playing, and he was one of the early champions, folks like Jeremy and Michael and Tom at Sony Classics, and like I mentioned,
Gary
definitely reached out to us and said, "We've got this movie, come see Star Maps." And so we saw the movie, and Sherry did an interview with Miguel right before the film played.
And tell us who Sherry is.
Sherry Barner, our co-founder, who's not here with us, who's based in L.A. She's now a talent manager. She was a great interviewer, and she sat down and chatted with Miguel before the movie. No one knew the movie yet,
Wasn't her first interview, though, at Sundance with Hugh Grant?
Yeah.
And she had never done an interview before?
Yeah.
We've all been there.
but I'll hand the story off to Mark, because Mark had befriended the guy who was selling the film. And normally the way these things work, just to sort of set the stage, is that, there was a kind of structure, and Gary can speak to this as well. Filmmakers would go to the festival, and films would go there with their representation, and you sort of... When you made a deal, you would announce it in a very formal way with a press release to one of the two trade journalists who were there covering the deals. And then there were these kind of scrappy kids who were doing their printed newsletter.
We started doing a print daily at Sundance because the trades didn't print in Salt Lake City. They had to send all their stuff back to L.A. They printed there, and then they shipped it back to Sundance, so they were a day late on everything.
And so Mark's at a party, because Mark was definitely the most social and still is the most social of our group, and that was actually important because you were making those early relationships with, I guess it was Jed at the time, who was selling the film,
right.
And you got some information.
And he told me that they had sold the film to his Fox Searchlight.
Overnight.
And so not being used to us being there with a print daily, he was just sort of chatting about it and told me about it. I mean, he knew I was a journalist. He knew what he was doing. I think he actually really knew what he was doing. My secret is that the thought is that he knew he was subverting the trades. And we went back and wrote it up and put it in the, in the daily that we were doing that night, overnight, and started handing it out the next morning at all the morning screenings, which was a day before any of the trades were going to do it. And let's just say the trades were not pleased by this.
Neither was the publicist at the time, who's now a studio head. She was very unhappy that as she was working on the press release to go to Variety, I'm sitting in the business lounge, and somebody called the office, and the volunteer who answered the phone like yelled out the news across the across the crowded room, and the woman who was the publicist, now studio executive, sitting next to me, like melted down at the fact that this information had just been shared with another journalist, and that we were suddenly in charge of going to take this story out ahead of her, kind of strategy through the trades and all of that.
So this is interesting because there's a leap here from this idea of community to the idea of reporting,
right?
and being reported to and all of that. So how did that happen? I mean, because that's not the same thing.
It was like a Busby Berkeley musical. It really was. I don't know if any of you have ever seen any of the Andy Hardy movies where, you know, somebody says, let's put on a play. And somebody else says, my uncle's got a barn we can use. Yeah. And so we were doing sort of online stuff, occasionally doing like weekly sort of, you know, just doing little stuff. And then somebody said, well, why don't we do an actual organized newsletter? And I had met a gentleman by the name of Carol Martesco Fenster, who was the founding publisher of Filmmaker Magazine and was one of the founders of the IFFM. And I met him at the IFFM, and he was very much involved in what the nascent...
And the IFFM was a market for projects in development in New York at the time that was run by the Independent Feature Project.
Thank you. And he was very much into what the kids were doing, and he was also very much into the internet and the nascent World Wide Web and what you could do with it. So he said, oh, I've, you know, got some office space that we're not using. Why don't you guys come in? And then we were like, well, sure, we've got computers, we've got an office space, we've got dial-up, let's start a daily. Not realizing, of course, that actually once you commit to doing a daily, you actually have to do it every day. But but that's basically, it was just sort of like a, okay, let's do this now.
Mm-hmm. That was so critical to forming the IndieWire identity. I mean, as somebody who came into the story much later, one of the things that I came to realize is that if you go to a party that has some journalists at it, none of the talent, the filmmakers or the actors, usually want to talk to them. Mm-hmm. You know, they're afraid they're going to say something, get in trouble or whatever, but everybody knows the IndieWire guys. They're at everything. They love movies. You can trust those guys until they, you know, get a scoop or something.
Well, we made it pretty clear early on that we didn't give a rat's butt about who's dating who, that we weren't a gossip site. We didn't care about that. We cared about the filmmakers. We weren't going to write, you know, we also made a sort of amongst ourselves decision that if we went to a film at a film festival and it was terrible, we just weren't going to write about it unless it was terrible because it was racist or sexist or something like that. But if it was just bad, why slam on this poor filmmaker's career? Who knows what their second film or third film is going to be like? So that we sort of, that's how we sort of built up a lot of trust in the community.
So you kind of make this big both conceptual and physical leap to creating a daily. Who pays for that? I mean, because you guys are started this out of your spirits.
We did. we had free office space. Internet access was, the office was, you know, I suppose Filmmaker paid for our extra bandwidth. Yeah. and our phone bill. I mean,
no one was getting paid in those very early years. I lived in L.A. at the time, and at some point, Eugene had already moved to New York. I got involved because I knew these guys, obviously.
My next question.
Well, and it was because they needed, I can't remember what festival it was, but there was some festival going on in L.A., and one of you called me and said, do you want to go to this? And I was like, do I get to go to the party? And I was like, sure. And then it just kind of like, that's where it kind of began. And I started writing for free through at least the late 90s.
I mean, I think it speaks to the fact that even today there's a hunger for, if you're really interested in going into a field like independent film and festivals are a great entree to kind of taking that next step in a career or trying to start a career, right? We were in the same position in our 20s. And like Brian says, like, do I get to go to the party? That means I get to connect with people, find other people who are interested in what I'm doing, have a free drink, get some free food, see some free movies. It was a way in, and there weren't, again, I think at least for me, maybe you guys feel the same. But when we were in our 20s, and just getting started, it just felt like kind of like it felt very difficult to sort of start. What would end up being a career. This didn't feel like a step towards a career. It felt like just like a natural thing we should be doing. The fact that it ended up leading to something that became a business is still kind of surprising to me and was surprising at the time. But I think it the more we connected with people like ourselves who had similar interests, and Mark wanted to be a filmmaker and started making films with some of the people that we met along the way. You know, I had a full-time job at the time and was doing this on the side. Brian was doing other things and went off traveling for part of it and then came back. But it was just, we were all kind of trying to find our way, and we knew that we wanted film to be part of our lives, and this was sort of a step. But in terms of funding, I mean, the very little funding that we ever had came from Mark's mom, whose film we saw today, and she made a small investment in the company just to get us started so we could pay the amount of money it would be required to trademark the name and create those first business cards and that kind of stuff. Like, it was...
caps that Mickey Cottrell wore for like 15 years.
but that was our only ever investment until we sold the company. I mean, we sold advertising ultimately and built the company that way organically.
Yeah, I mean, the hidden secret of IndieWire is that you guys survived with all the tiniest of overhead for years and years. But that was really smart, because if you look at the dot-com bust and everything that happened there, people were over-investing in ideas that didn't require that kind of investment. So in some ways, you mirrored what independent filmmakers were doing, which is figuring out, okay, how do you make something with limited resources?
What was amazing in those days to me was how broad your coverage seemed to be, considering how few people actually were creating that coverage and generating it. And it was remarkable, because those of us who are part of this world, you know, we're hungry for this, and you guys like were fuel. I mean, you were fueling our you were sating our needs. You know.
Well, Brian was always the one who said, he would always tell me and others, like, he was the one that he would never want to sort of pull the curtain back.
I didn't.
I mean, it was something that you were emphatic about. He was like, we should, because we were covering, we were trying to cover so aggressively at a festival like Sundance. We would go there and we'd be working, you know, 18 hours a day in shifts, you know, kind of covering the festival from morning to morning, with just a few people all kind of piled into a condo wherever we could get space and spending very little money, as little money as possible. And sometimes I was the one who would want to, like, kind of tell people, like, look, it's just like two or three people on the core team who are doing this. And Brian wisely said, you know, no, don't, you're everywhere already. We're out there covering as many films, and publicists are giving us access, and don't break down that mystery and keep it vague.
I internally borrowed a little line from a U2 song, and I said, but we're even better than the real thing.
That's great.
And you destroy the myth.
I wanted to keep the myth alive, because we were a very small group.
On the other hand, if everybody thinks that you're large and self-sustaining, nobody gives you any money.
Yeah, there was that.
So, the foundation of so much of your reporting was from the film festival circuit, from the film festival world. Yeah. So, Brian, talk a little bit about the kind of synergy between what IndieWire was trying to be and this community of programmers and festival organizers and the festivals themselves, and what each meant to each other. Or anyone else on the panel.
Yeah, I mean, chime in, obviously, but I mean, is it bad to say that we were all kind of friends and I felt like that we were in it together in a certain way? I mean, I did get to know the programmers really well. I mean, that doesn't mean that there weren't times when there were, my agenda didn't quite match up with, our agenda didn't quite match up with their agenda.
There were times when we had to write something that actually pissed off some of our friends, and we're like, look, this, we're not, you read the article, tell me if anything we said was untrue. And they couldn't, but they were annoyed because we were criticizing them.
Yeah. Do you remember any examples of that?
Actually, I do.
Okay.
Right here. Eric joined us a little bit later on in the process, but I don't know if I want to name the festival. I mean, it's out there. It's in the thing. He wrote something about the Tribeca Film Festival. And we had been going there from the very beginning. It came, you know, Tribeca Film Festival, for those of you who don't know, came out of the ashes of 9/11. They had a really great, you know, came. It was a very great, noble idea. They did have some great films, but I think Eric took it in a different way. And Eugene and I were really good friends with a lot of the people that were the organizers there. But Eric kind of had a different take on it, and he was our critic. And
well, specifically the piece that I wrote opened by citing they had a bumper that played before all the movies. This was in 2008, so not that long ago, with Martin Scorsese. saying, I've lost the narrative thread, and he's like trying to order something at a drugstore or something like that. And I use that as sort of a metaphor for this festival that had lost its narrative thread. What exactly is Tribeca supposed to be doing? And I wasn't doing that because I was in a complete vacuum. I was responding to what I heard from a lot of people. And I think that's the crucial point. If you look at a lot of criticism and you look at a lot of reporting on the industry, people don't talk to the community. And the value of IndieWire is that we reflect that community irrespective of, you know, whose agenda needs to be served at any particular point in time. And so the value of doing a story like that is that you then help that story get out there and hopefully make a difference. If you look at the way that festival structure changed it, you know, maybe there was some sort of response to that. To their credit, they didn't, you know, try to make us take it down or something like that because it was real journalism. You know,
and it had a massive impact, that story.
It's interesting, too, because you don't always see it when you're on the inside, because you see these people, you know all of them. And the more that you can see the intricacies of this community, which is invisible to most people who see the end result, the movies, the more you see how fragile it is and how much value there is in really addressing what these problems are, because if you don't, you're not going to read about it in the arts and leisure section of the New York Times. They're thinking about, you know, how can we do the puff piece where we hang out with Warren Beatty for 6 hours, which, by the way, great article, but it's not going to make a difference.
Mm-hmm. So, and I think Eric, just to follow up on that point, Eric maintains that and carries the flag with the same spirit and approach that I think was there from the very beginning, and that is, again, it's very easy in journalism today to kind of follow the path that is prescribed to you by the publicist and the studio and the handler and the strategist and the personal publicist, whatever it may be. But I think that it's not as easy or as common today for a journalist or a critic or a culture writer to follow a different path to try to get to the same kind of end result and maybe find a different story. And so that's why, you know, when you see Eric at an event, he's trying not to follow the same path, and he's, you know, making those relationships with other filmmakers. I think the piece that, I mean, just to flash forward today for a moment, the piece that IndieWire wrote this week with different filmmakers commenting on the election.
It's great.
It's a really great piece, and I think what's really special about it is that, you know, a different version of that piece could have been written by you guys contacting all the publicists for each of the filmmakers that are quoted in that piece. But in fact, what Eric did and what the other folks at IndieWire did was reach out to the filmmakers that they have relationships with. And as I was telling Brian as we were reading the piece yesterday, like, these filmmakers want that outlet. You know, they want that way to speak out. And IndieWire is going to be fair and considerate of those voices and represent them, but also give that platform that I haven't seen anybody else write that article at all.
I think I saw someone have a question back there.
Just about Tribeca,
I just use that as an example, by the way. I'm not dissing Tribeca.
I will.
You know, they started with the best of intentions, but to me, it seems like they still don't have the narrative thread. But if you know what it is, could you explain it?
Maybe it's time for a sequel to that story.
Well, Eric covers this festival. Eric covers Tribeca more than any of us, and I think you could probably speak to it.
I mean, I don't want to
Sherry in the middle, by the way.
I don't want to get too lost in the weeds with that story, but I think this is actually a great photo of these guys at Sundance in '95 because, I mean, the element of the festival circuit that gave rise to IndieWire is more complex than it ever has been before. And a great example is just being in this room. I mean, everybody has a film festival, and some film festivals are really well programmed and suit the needs of their communities. This one clearly does. You travel all over the world and you see different ways in which that happens. It's also really easy to take advantage of that system. And it gets more and more complicated by the day. You have platforms like Without a Box, which basically allows somebody to just create a festival with absolutely no connections whatsoever, no validity, and charge money to people. And it's really hard to police that sort of stuff. And so I think it's just become more and more of a complicated climate to understand what the purpose of a festival is. At the same time, festivals are more valuable than ever because it's just a really cluttered landscape, and these are the ways in which, you know, stuff breaks through the noise.
And it's the and festivals now, with the decline of art house cinema outside of major cultural centers, are the only outlet people have to communally see independent film. you know, with other like-minded folks on a flickering image. Well, they don't flicker anymore, but an image on a wide screen. And that's the value of film festivals, and one of the values of film festivals in today's world. But I'm interested in your perspectives on that very thing, and what IndieWire both contributes to and derives from the festival world itself.
For me, festivals were always, I was always like the festival guy. Like at one point, I think my title was festivals editor. Mm-hmm. We changed titles pretty much weekly because there were like three or four of us and like, oh, okay, I'll be editor in chief this week. I loved festivals. And so when I went to a festival and Richard Schenkman directed a film that he co-written with his writing partner, John Cryer. Now, John was in between, you know, after Pretty in Pink and a couple of other films, he just sort of started doing films that nobody ever saw and went nowhere. And he was in the middle of this reinventing his career as a writer and producer, you know, long before Two and a Half Men. So when I met him, he was just a guy with a film at a film festival. And when we met Bryan Singer, he was just some guy with his first film at a film festival. Mm-hmm. So that's, like, for me, for other filmmakers.
And what was that film, Mark?
Public Access.
Yeah.
And it won the grand, and it shared the grand jury prize with Ruby in Paradise. But, you know, that for me is one of the great benefits of going to a film festival for students and for young filmmakers is to go, and you have no idea who you're going to run into. Yeah, it's possible you'll walk into a bar and sit next to Werner Herzog, but it's also possible that you'll meet a filmmaker who, you know, 20 years later you develop a working relationship with, and you, like, I can, there's a dozen people that we know that met at, like, North Carolina School of the Arts, and all of a sudden they're, you know, inventing mumblecore, for better or for worse. And you just, and honestly, to speak to Sarasota, you never know who you're going to be naked in a swimming pool with.
Well, there you go as a topic of conversation, Brian.
Or who you'll see naked in a swimming pool.
That's where all the deals go down, right?
Yeah.
Hot tubs.
It's all about being naked. Yeah.
So could I ask a question? It's kind of a really practical working question. If it's too much for this, then we'll talk later. But another purpose of film festivals, obviously, for those independent films that do not have distribution, and maybe you're going to, you know, get some help. So I am trying to help support somebody whose documentary tonight is showing. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering, are people going to, I think it's sold out, The Promise. Are you guys?
Well, it's the North American premiere of that film, and it's an important film coming into the marketplace.
That's what my hope is. And Jens Søring, who, I don't know if you know the story about it, but it's basically...
But that's not what this conversation's about the actual topic. But
yeah, no, but what I was going to ask is, do you have advice for how to get the word out at other, like, it's going to other film festivals?
Right.
And Jens Søring, who I'm trying to, you know, help promote the film with, he's asked me to, like,
okay,
just talk to people here and see, can anyone...
So what can the community, what can the various platforms do to share any particular title that's being released through the festival world, or
I mean,
that's being introduced?
Eric can speak to it from IndieWire's perspective today. The only thing I would add in, just to interject for a moment, I now work at an organization that runs a dozen film festivals a year, in addition to retrospective screenings and first-run movies at the Film Society of Lincoln Center. And I'm always looking, I or my colleagues are always looking to what's playing at various festivals. So when a film is having its North American premiere at this festival or is having a U.S. premiere at a different festival, whatever it might be, just that information, because it's, the one thing is that's great is it's so easy for a filmmaker or a rep or whoever it might be to share a link. So even though I'm the only one from my organization who's here this weekend, Brian and I are from this organization, none of our programming team are here. We read about a film in the catalog, or we meet someone at a party or hear about a film, we can share that information back with folks who are back in New York, and they can reach out and ask for a screener. Or just the fact that you're playing at two or three or four festivals in this kind of concentrated period helps elevate the awareness, right, among a certain group of people that are noticing that.
And the other thing about film festivals and about the independent film world is that the programmers and festival organizers are a community unto themselves, and they talk to each other. And if there's a title that's played well at a festival, and is recognized as that, one programmer calls the other, hey, do you have any good title? Wow, we had this amazing screening of whatever it happens to be at our festival. And then IndieWire reports on that if it makes enough of an impact in the youth. So how does that happen, Eric?
Yeah, it's funny. A lot of filmmakers think if they make something really good, then obviously people are going to notice. And that's just not the reality. I mean, any case study you hear of you know, say, the Blair Witch story or something like that, you know, where this movie just kind of all of a sudden becomes a phenomenon, some brilliant sales agents, publicists, marketing people behind that kind of stuff. So make sure you have a good publicist. Gary Springer knows where to find us. The best ones are people that, you know, aren't taking on a lot of bad movies. You know, look at the stuff they've done in the past. They have great one-to-one relationships with journalists. They know who they can text at 2 a.m. when they haven't heard back from you. And, you know, they can formulate how to present this to people. And don't over-obsess with getting a review. A review can be valuable in certain contexts. You know, if you're the first review out of Sundance and it's a rave and all the buyers are there, so they're going to be looking at that, it has a certain currency. But at this stage of the game, you know, you're going around to smaller festivals and so forth, you know, think about what are the other things that are interesting about the movie? Is there another way to tell the story of this movie? I mean, at IndieWire now we have so many different people. It's kind of wild because I first met these guys in an East Village bagel shop and there was no office and they were the only staffers.
It was a nice bagel shop.
It was a nice bagel shop. I don't think it's there anymore. We had 10 people in New York and that's just the New York team. And one person whose full-time job is running the filmmaker toolkit section, which predates my time at IndieWire but has become one of the core sections of the site in the sense that it really is the DNA of IndieWire because, I mean, yeah, he started it. But what it has done since it started is it's come to define why this brand exists in the sense that it creates a voice for the community. So we do things like first persons where filmmakers will write about their experiences or, you know, people talk about, you know, how I shot this movie in X number of days. There are so many different ways that you can formulate it to make your story exciting to people. So as long as you're willing to experiment with that, eventually somebody's going to want to do that story.
And as long as you're willing to work really hard to make it happen and to be at places where you can network with those in this community who are influencers, in the greater world.
And I want to second something Eric said, because I'm the only one up here who's been a journalist and a publicist for the last 3 years. It's a little schizophrenic, though, the journalist-publicist thing. My daughter. And so, you know...
Donald Trump.
Moving on.
The thing about reviews that he said, it's really, really... There's so many films... And honestly, if you know, we get so many clients that are like, oh my God, we don't have enough reviews. This person didn't. Yeah. They're not anywhere near as important as you think they are. They're really not.
I think it requires, the last thing I'll just add to, before we get to the next question, is the last thing that I think is required is just patience too. You know, if your film has its North American premiere here and you don't get frustrated if you don't get all the reviews and coverage that you want your first time out, I'm sure an expert publicist like Gary would tell you it comes over time. And if the movie's good and you can take it from festival to festival and start building those connections and things like that, that's actually going to help more than kind of the immediate response. It just kind of takes a little bit of patience too.
Yeah, back there. So that's a great question, and this is pulling back the curtain.
I mean, I will say earlier on, you could probably speak to it much better now, obviously, but earlier on, I mean, Eric was a bit of our scapegoat because he was our critic. You know, Eugene and I knew the industry people. We knew the heads of Sony Classics, you know, IFC, the distributors, and we'd be like, IndieWire gave us a terrible review. We're like, God, I didn't agree with Eric, you know? But, he's our critic.
I don't have that luxury.
Yeah, I mean, we consciously didn't. Eugene was editor-in-chief. I was managing editor. And so we were a little bit removed. I mean, not to say that we wouldn't give our opinion. I'm not saying that we're two-faced and like, you know, it wasn't like that.
There should be church and state within the publication.
But, yeah, there was a church and state, and we wanted someone, you know, but obviously one could be swayed. Some of these people were our friends, right? So we could be swayed, perhaps, by the fact that they're our friends, but that's why we got a critic. I mean, someone who's an great critic, and I thought, which we thought Eric did a great job on, and he's very honest, and it was on him.
Yeah, but I muddied the waters a little bit because then I became an editor and an assistant critic.
It's a little different now.
You wear a lot of hats. But I got involved with the noir because I've been a freelancer going to all these different film festivals when I didn't have the luxury of deciding how my stories would take shape. Sometimes someone would hire me to review a movie. Other times I had to write a profile or whatever. But I like being at the center of all that kind of stuff. And anything I wrote was a form of advocacy of sorts. You know, sometimes I'd say, oh, this would be a great feature in the New York Times, and sometimes I would say, oh, I want to write an essay about this filmmaker or something like that. So to me, I mean, the ethos are the same, and if somebody has a problem with some perspective I have, I will always talk to them about it. Not if they send me an angry Facebook message or something like that, but if I run into them at a party, I mean, it's an honest thing.
I think the one thing that I've noticed, and I won't single out any specific journalists or outlets in this comment, but I think to your question, I think that we're all part of different communities, and to be a part of a community means to have values and to be responsible. And so as people who have been in this community for a while, I think that we take that, I know I do, I know we all do on this stage, and Mitch could answer this question just as easily as any of us. We care about this community, but we also have to be responsible, and sometimes it means speaking out about things that need to be addressed or need to be discussed. Sometimes it means holding up something that's not getting enough attention, or a person, or an issue, or an idea that's not getting traction. But I think that we've tried, all of us have tried to surround ourselves with, at every stage of IndieWire's life, people who uphold those same ideals. And that's something that I've always thought about. We talked about it from the very beginning. And I think when that picture of Mark and Sherry and I was up there earlier, I think that we connected in a very specific way around a certain view on the arts and diversity and inclusion and just being really thoughtful about where we want, how we wanted culture to be represented in the moment that we were starting.
But, well, one thing very interesting about that photograph was, considering the time, it was 95, I think, that picture was taken.
Are we able to put that photograph back up of the three?
No white people in that picture, which in considering the media landscape in the 90s was reasonably rare. And so we all came to it from the point of view of Sherry and I are mixed race, Eugene is a Latino American, and we all came from it from the point of view of inclusion and that point of view. So we all came to it without not the status quo point of view.
So Brian was your attempt to be inclusive then?
Yes. Brian was our token white guy. And I thought that, the other thing is that the community, at least what we tried to do in the community, is it is at its best self-policing. So when you see, we don't generally tolerate jerks particularly well in terms of, like, you know, there was an interview, and this is public, so I'll say it, you know, the DGA did an interview. We were in the DGA building in New York. That's where the Directors Guild building in New York. And Vincent Gallo was doing an interview, and we were invited to cover.
This is following the release of Buffalo 66.
Yeah. And we were invited to cover the event. And during the event, he referred to Angelica Houston as a word that generally in the United States starts with C, is not generally used. And we reported that, and Vincent and the Directors Guild flew into a tizzy and demanded that we take the story down and correct it.
And their lawyer sent a really nasty letter.
You know, sent us a letter two floors up to three floors up to our office, to a cease and desist letter. And we just laughed because we were invited by a jerk. And, like, look, if you're going to be a jerk, you're going to get called on it, and you did it in a public forum. So I'm sorry, we're going to call you on it. I mean, that's...
I mean, if you're going to call a woman a derogatory word of that kind in a public setting, it would be irresponsible for us to not report that.
Right.
The corollary to that is while these relationships and the community and all of that makes for a great mix, how do you parlay that into a business and make money at it?
Good question. We're still trying to figure that out.
It is so funny. I would be at, festivals all the time, and people are like, how do you guys make money?
Yeah.
Well, you had two corporate suitors in the last 10 years who acquired.
Yeah, I mean, I think now it's a little bit.
What's
I think the earlier on part of it was like how it made money. I mean,
in terms of the two owners of IndieWire have both been wealthy individuals with philanthropic beliefs and core beliefs in using their wealth to support philanthropic and I was going to say noble, but that's not the right word.
And an artistic expression, worthy
organizations within the arts. So as Ted Leonsis, who very early on we admired and we saw what he and Steve Case were doing at AOL. And you mentioned AOL, and Mark and I went down to AOL and we had an early meeting with them and we admired what their ideas about community and content, and that's what AOL really is and still is in different ways. And now, you know, Jay Penske, who owns IndieWire, again, someone who's had tremendous success and has applied that success towards hopefully, you know, towards supporting and committing his own. I mean, Eric knows him a lot better than I do, but my conversations with him are just, he cares deeply about the things that he puts his resources towards. And that's something that IndieWire is very fortunate about, especially in a media landscape where what's driving those companies is not the same.
And Eric, perhaps you could address this. It's, you know, the current owners, Penske, is, you know, owns Variety also. Once one could argue to be the competition or a competition to IndieWire.
And Brian's now a competitor to IndieWire himself because he's
I write for Deadline Hollywood now, which
he writes IndieWire.
We're downstairs from them, or LA, and LA.
Down the hallway, actually.
Yeah.
So Eric, how does it work with this new corporate structure?
Well, the prelude to all this, and I think it's essential that it's mentioned on any panel about IndieWire, is the late, great Brian Clark, who is essentially a publisher at GMD Studios and also a longtime friend of these guys. And I always thought he was a great guy when I met him.
He was my roommate for a while in New York.
Roommate. He was one of the guys.
It's very close.
really valuable in terms of formulating what you guys were looking at, what was in motion, and being able to formulate it theoretically. And there was this great email exchange that you resurrected that we now use all the time where he said, IndieWire is a brand, damn it. And it's true, and that damn it is part of it because there's an authenticity to that. And the reality of the media landscape is you can create clickbait. We're all familiar with it. You click on something and you're like, yeah, I guess we'll take the stupid quiz or whatever. But you're not going to remember that. You're not going to internalize it, and you're not going to develop a deep relationship with it. The branding element needs to come from a more authentic place. And so something like Variety, which is this industry trade bible, has a very strong brand. I don't think it has sort of the brand affinity where people, you know, are you know, they love this thing. They need it. It's a service.
Except for Milton Tabbitt.
there are people in the community who are obsessed with you know, trade stories and things like that, and you can geek out about that. There's an astonishing history to Variety, and they've done incredible things, and I think are starting to become more keen on what the digital landscape can offer. But IndieWire's always had that, and more importantly, we've always been on the ground. So from a business standpoint, that is a very elusive thing that's very attractive to people, and I think it's why we've had the owners that we've had, is because we don't have to fake it. You guys started it in a way that didn't have a business mandate, and now the business is driven by that mandate. So, you know, you get the last laugh.
But I'm going to kind of more directly answer your question. I mean, before it was owned by Ted Leonsis, who is, you know, obviously he was, for those of you know, he was part of AOL and then PMC. I mean, we were owned by GMD Studios, which was Brian Clark, who Eric talked about. But we didn't, you know, we were a very small group. It was driven by advertising, but we honestly weren't making a lot of money. I used to joke that, I mean, I know that I traveled for about a third of the year, and that was to go to film festivals. Yeah. But I used to joke that I was part of the poverty jet set. So
I use that joke all the time, yeah. By the way.
So Brian, talk about two things, because since we brought up the Filmmakers Toolkit, go back a little and talk about IPOP and then about the Filmmakers Toolkit, because those are kind of revolutionary, both in terms of a platform and a service and an online presence.
I mean, the toolkit, which, you know, I have to give major kudos to IndieWire now. They've expanded it out, and it's wonderful. It's a great resource. If you haven't checked it out, definitely please do. But I mean, it was just an area where it meant to be just like that. It was a toolkit. It was meant to be a resource, information for filmmakers with logistical things. I mean, I used to do a profile of festival programmers. you know, well, who are these festival programmers? Mm-hmm. So it'd be like, and I did send out email interviews and have them come back, like, what were your favorite films? I mean, it got a little more depth than that, but that was sort of the beginnings of the toolkit. So iPop.
Maybe while he's talking about iPop, you could just
now you can bring up
flip through some photos. Of the photos.
Yeah. So iPop. So this. Yes. So iPop, which this is an example of. This is from the Toronto Film Festival at an IFC Films dinner. iPop, which our philosophy was that it was meant for the next day. We wanted you to feel like you were at the party. And this during your hangover, this is to help refresh your memory. This was at an IFC. I don't remember exactly the year, but then we have Gael Garcia Bernal here, Harmony Korine, Gus Van Sant, and Diego Luna. And
it's so unfortunate that none of them had a career after this.
No, exactly. But I mean, just picture this: the heydays of iPop were basically the very early 2000s up until roughly 2009 or so. And so this was before everyone had an iPhone, and this was before Instagram. And I would walk around with a little camera, and, you know, usually at film parties, you had these, you know, kind of imposing men with these huge cameras, and then it was like, oh my God, okay. So then everyone had to pose and do certain things. I only had a glass of wine in my hand, and a little camera.
Little camera.
Little camera.
And
I made sure it was a little
big
camera.
Big glass of wine, little camera.
And I, you know, I was like, oh, can I take your picture for IndieWire? And then that was it. And Mitch also appeared in iPop. It wasn't just celebrities. Let's see who we have here.
Well, Dev Patel.
He's
in a movie here tomorrow night, Lion.
Yeah.
I mean, it was interesting with the other thing that where iPop, Morgan Spurlock.
We were the first people to ever take a picture of Morgan Spurlock. Right? It was before it was at Sundance. And it was before Supersize Me had ever
been. This is a good example of what iPop would do, because that's Marcus Hu, who runs Strand Releasing, in A Pitch of Pong, where it's a thought, Cole, who made Uncle Boon Me. So seeing distributor and filmmaker pair, I mean, that was, I think, what was really interesting about iPop. I would get excited at a party
like that,
take an iPop or something.
That was actually kind of my favorite thing, was to get an industry person. Yeah. And then
the same guy, Marcus Hu, this time at an Oscar party with Anthony Bregman, who we mentioned earlier as an early supporter and now a major producer.
I love that. It's like distributors.
The Duplass brothers at the Woodstock Film Festival.
The one thing I want to add about iPop is it grew out of something that, it grew out of, again, an area of indie Wire that Mark really developed. And again, you know, it would have been very easy for us to sit in an office somewhere writing about all of this stuff and from a disconnected point of view. And I think, you know, in the earliest days, you know, Mark was interviewing folks in hot tubs, or Shaka was assigning people to interview folks in hot tubs, or taking pictures again in a you know, at a festival outside the normal, like, quote unquote, step and repeat kind of setup format. And what Brian did when he came to IndieWire was really kind of amplify that, kind of accelerate that into something that became this, like, regular column of pictures. And what's interesting about this group of pictures, we spent a number of weeks earlier this year assembling kind of a best of iPop group photo photos.
We have thousands of photos. I mean, it's kind of crazy.
But was that, you know, it was just this. It was in some cases photos of, like, you know, legends like Robert Altman, and this photo was again, nobody else has this photo. We were at dinner, Hamptons Film Festival, you know, Robert Altman, his wife, Michael Lynn and his wife, and they just got together for this photo. Brian snapped the photo, and they liked it so much that you know, this photo was eventually sent to Mr. Altman, because it was just that personal kind of moment. But there's also first photos of a lot of people, so like that Duplass brothers, those guys are doing so much right now, but when we met them at the Woodstock Film Festival, it was really at the beginning of their career. So it's either that, or it's unique combinations of, like, you know, Chloe Sevigny with Olivier Assayas, or Wong Kar-wai with Ang Lee. People who also were, it was fun, it would be fun to watch a party take place, and you know, those two guys were just so excited to have a few minutes together, because they live on opposite sides of the world, and then, you know, of course they want their picture taken by IndieWire to have it documented, but also just to kind of capture that combination of people. So it's an interesting mix of, you know, executives, filmmakers in the early stage.
Wow. That kind Chloe of thing. 7 and
incredible. Yeah, I mean, I used to get excited going to Olivia Assis. I mean, I would want to take an iPop photo if I saw somebody from the industry around, you know.
Jesse Eisenberg and Noah Baumbach.
Yeah, right. And that was, yeah.
Squid in the Whale. Whale. Yeah.
That natural history
museum. Oh, wow. Incredible.
This one was, so if you ever go to Toronto during the film festival, just try and find out try and find out where the Sony Classics dinner is, because you will find the Star Wattage up the wazoo.
Yeah.
But this, they're all kind of like standing outside during the cocktail period, and this was actually during the cocktail period, and this Bennett Miller and Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Phil and Bennett, who we became friends with, Bennett especially, they went to school together, and they were friends.
I have a couple of brief stories about that. Bennett, we met Bennett when his first film, The Cruise, played at LA, at the LA IFF, I guess, was the first time we saw it, and then he's like, oh, you know, it's playing in Newport. Do you guys want to go? And so we contacted Newport, and we're like, yeah, we'd love to go and cover. So Bennett drove Eugene and I up to Newport from New York, in like his mother's old Mercedes, and we drove all the way up there, and we stayed. We had to share a dorm room at Salve Regina University, so we were staying in an old nunnery, basically, where all the beds squeaked, this is like the old, like, right, the room next door was Rob Bindler, who made a film called Hands on a Hard Body, which is a great documentary. He and his girlfriend were next door, and then next door, I don't remember who else, but it was that's, you know, how all this thing started. And then, you know, Bennett told us a story that he told me. He and Dan Futterman wrote Capote and Bennett directed it, and they all went to school with Phil, who started it, and they all had a group. They had a pact from when they were much younger that the first one of them to win an Oscar was going to bark his acceptance speech, and they made this deal. So when Philip Seymour Hoffman won the Oscar for Capote, I was sitting there and I'm waiting, and I knew he wasn't actually going to, but I was just waiting, hoping that at the very end he was going to lean in and go. but he didn't do it, because I've heard that basically when you win an Oscar, your mind just goes blank. So I'm hoping that he just forgot.
This was the very first picture of I think it was at the Spirit Awards.
It was at the Guggenheim.
Oh, at the Guggenheim. This was the premiere of E Tu Mama Tambien in New York. This was, by the way, a great party. Everyone had so much tequila. But Diego Luna.
Oh, go,
Diego,
go back. Go
yeah,
back.
Sorry, go back. Diego Luna and Gael Garcia Bernal, they're like, oh, you're going to take our picture? It was so cute.
As are they.
Yes.
You know, I know we don't have a ton of time left, and I think it is important talking about where we are as a community now, because, you know, the idea of indie film has been fragmented. We launched a TV section 5 years ago. We now have 3 full-time TV people in L.A., or 4 full-time TV people in L.A., and some people covering digital media and so forth. And what's interesting is that there is a connectivity to those worlds that we're seeing now. So a lot of what you see reflected here, sort of what the indie film world was, is now expanded into these other areas. I mean, to me, it's sort of like the Star Wars universe or something. Like, you see there's a movie, and then you start to read up on the mythology and all these other different characters and all these people who you know, have different origin stories. And that's what this is, essentially. It's this giant sort of self-contained universe, and it's constantly being rebooted. Yeah. You know, there's Matt Dendler, who got to start as a programmer for Southwest.
The potential is so much, is just so great right now, because the outlets that young creatives have as paths for themselves is really interesting, and you guys are exploring, you know, even with like Judith, who you guys hired, like you're exploring content that's not just limited to a film that plays at a film festival regionally, but that might be something on, it might be like a YouTube video, or it might be a pilot. You know, Brian now works for a film festival called Series Fest that he's starting, which is about independent pilot.
Going to our third year, but yes.
But point being that there's so many other outlets that creative indie directors or artists are using now to express
like we were at this reception, Werner Herzog yesterday said to us, the distributors are just too slow. I'm you know, not so much that he's prolific, which he is, but he's like, traditional distribution is too slow. There's the New York release, then the LA release, then they roll it out, then maybe it's digital, then you have a sales agent that sells it to a foreign distributor. He said, with Netflix, my last film's on Netflix, it's on, you know, 180 countries like that, and everybody can watch it all at once.
The universe has changed. And Eric, continue your discussion, if you will, about the role, the place of IndieWire in this change, in this new universe that we're entering, which we're all puzzled about, to be honest.
Well, it's the best of times and the worst of times, you know, because it's just so easy to get out there and to produce something and develop an audience for it if you're savvy enough to know how to do it. At the same time, it's harder than ever to break through the noise. And there are some great examples of people who are innovating. I love the HBO show High Maintenance, which we started tracking as a web series, and then it was sold to a cable show. And seeing things like that, I think, are sort of picking up the narrative where that started with the Sundance sort of experience. And, you know, the opportunities for sort of DIY creativity are enormous. And there are people who are so uncompromising in their vision that they may end up isolating themselves, but 'twas ever thus. You know, I think what's really fascinating is that we're just finding more and more opportunities to profile and discover people who are creating stuff that's not easy to get out there.
People like Mariah Carey. I mean, who had heard of her?
Yeah, I know.
No one had heard of her.
A real underdog, that one.
Yeah. But I also, broke her to the world. Yeah.
I love seeing when that kind of connectivity happens. I mean, Moonlight is a great example, right? Yeah. Moonlight is this brilliant, brilliant, brilliant movie. It's got Oscar traction. And those of us who discovered Barry Jenkins, the director, with his first film, Medicine for Melancholy, at South by Southwest in 08, are astonished. It's surreal to see that kind of thing go so far as to have Chris Rock saying, you know, Barry Jenkins for president, you know? But it's amazing because it still is true that people can break through that noise with a strong vision and people to support it.
Was that the independent filmmaker Mickey Rooney?
Another indie.
Well, you never know who you're going to write.
You never know who you're going to write.
So this is interesting. We do have only a few minutes left. I'll take some questions. But but there's a festival programmer.
Hey, this is something that I've said to a couple of y'all privately, but it strikes me that it would be meaningful to say in a public forum as well. Going back a little bit to what you're saying about sort of your focus being not on finding what you can slam, but although you can slam stuff too, but your real passion being finding the things that you want to bring to the world and call attention to them. I just want to say that I think that's really beautiful, and that's something we try to do at my magazine as well, and that I want to give you sort of third-party affirmation in front of all these people here that you're not only an inspiration to the filmmakers and to the audience, but to your colleagues as well, you know, and I just want to affirm you in that and congratulate you on that and say thanks.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Yes.
Yeah, a quick question kind of relating to yours here. Going back to the politics of sort of festivals, I direct a festival myself, so I have some experience in this, but we had some negative publicity a couple of years ago, and this was from a national publication, somebody who had heard about, you know, our festival and asked to come out, and it was a very odd situation that basically she came back and was taking the position of, well, it shouldn't be necessarily a submission-based process. You should focus on curation.
Mm-hmm.
And so it raised a whole, you know, conversation, and I was trying to explain to her, well, my whole desire, the reason why I started the festival, was really to be a career launcher, to do what you guys were talking about, to bring, you know, awareness to some of these indie filmmakers. And it's not about the politics. Instead of going out and cherry-picking,
But it's a major issue. As someone who runs film festivals and consults to them, it's a constant discussion. The balance you try and achieve between films that you invite, that you curate either because you know the filmmaker or supporting a filmmaker or have discovered a filmmaker at another festival, and the this year at Sundance, 16,000 submissions that arrive, you know, across the portal. And how do you deal with all that? To Sundance's credit, for instance, I think 50 or 60% of their program this year came from submissions, which is a record for them. And that's interesting, but it's an ongoing dilemma and question in
that's
our...
That's Barry Jenkins right there.
Jeff
Deutschman.
It's not Eric Cohn, it's actually Jeff Deutschman.
It's an inside joke.
I programmed the documentary competition and the music doc competition at the Oxford Mississippi Film Festival. And I think what a lot of the general public and even some of the press don't understand is the financial realities of running a film festival. Mm-hmm. We have no government support on a national level. We have very, very little government support on a regional or statewide level. The large portion of the budget comes from submissions. Submissions, ticket sales, and sponsorship. And unless you actually are selling the tickets, you're not going to get the sponsors. and unless you get the films from submission, you're not going to get any of them. So you really can't, like, the only festivals that don't take submission fees are either festivals run by a massive organization that has a huge amount of money, or they're foreign festivals that have a lot of government money. So the fact is, we have to take submissions, but to your point, the good answer is, that's actually where we do find some great films.
That's right.
And we just do not have the time to spend all of our time going around to every festival. And we sometimes you'll find a world premiere that somebody just happened to submit to your festival. I'm going to program one or two of them, and at least one world premiere at Oxford, which is pretty rare for a small festival, and it's great.
Yeah, and I'd say that in the doc world, perhaps more than in the fiction world, it's a very, you know, it's a great well, because a lot of doc filmmakers aren't established, and we make all sorts of discoveries all the time that way. Any other? Yes, sir.
I remember Birth of a Nation got sold for like $15 million
17.
This year, and yeah. I think myself, I look at the gross, and it's still like, I think it grossed like $15 million, so I think it is, I guess Sundance is like, I don't know how big Sundance is, but it comes down to sea level. It's sort of like, your action is like, okay, so it made $15 million, and it's like...
Right.
There was a whole other thing that happened.
Yeah, that's an anomaly. Yeah, it's a little bit of an anomaly because of...
That film was poised to actually probably do significantly better than it actually did, because... And I think the controversy that happened with Nate Parker was definitely a huge contributor to the fact that film did not do very well.
And you guys did a lot of reporting on that.
Yeah, it was a messy situation, you know, but it is fascinating to follow the money and try to make sense of it, because you won't be able to a large degree, because box office, which was something that started to be made, you know, public for people to report on in the 80s, is not the only piece of the equation anymore, and the VOD marketplace is elusive since we are not given those figures. So you can't really understand completely how well that deal is paying off in the long run just on the basis of its box office.
Right.
Also, it's like, has there ever been a person that you met at a film festival that did, you're just wowed as both men? Because I remember one year Roger Ebert came to Virginia Film Festival, and then personally, I would have liked to meet him before he died, but that, and again, that's like, have you ever met someone that you were just like, wow, meeting this person, basically?
I mean, that's actually a great example. I mean, actually, I was really excited to meet Roger Ebert.
Yeah.
Roger was such a great supporter of us, too.
Yeah, he was a great supporter of us. I'll never forget, well, I mean, dumb story, but Eugene and I we'd left a Oscar party. It was, what happened? Like, the producer wasn't allowed to go. What was the deal again?
Was it the Hurt Locker?
It was the Hurt Locker. And we went up and covered, he had done something and he wasn't allowed to go to the actual Oscar ceremony. So he had a party at this unbelievable house in Malibu, and Eugene and I went up there. And so we reported from, I mean, we weren't invited to the Oscars, so we reported from this party. And we were driving down PCH, or I was driving, and Eugene was like on his phone, and he goes, Roger Ebert like posted our article, and I was like, it was so exciting. Yeah.
The answer to your question, honestly, Snoop Dogg and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Because all the people who are actually doing things that I'm really excited about, they become more like people to you the deeper you are in this scene.
For me, it was probably Deborah Foreman, the star of Valley Girl. Running into her at a party at Sundance in 1994, I think it was, I was just like, just completely starstruck.
You say yours, and I'll say mine.
Yeah, I mean, I think early at Sundance, I was the film Paris is Burning was had a huge impact on me when I was at UCLA, and it's what kind of turned me on to independent documentary, and so, you know, meeting Jenny Livingston at Sundance a couple of years after I started going. Was really special, just because it's sort of meeting people at festivals whom, you know, whose films you liked originally, like a Todd Haynes or a Jenny Livingston or any number of other people, was just kind of exciting, and getting to know folks like that and staying in touch with them over the years has been really, really meaningful.
Well, I didn't know we were going to get all serious.
Okay, I'll be name-droppy for one. How's that?
Go ahead.
All right. I was at the Berlin Film Festival and had no idea this was going to happen. We got an email from someone saying, well, there was a certain pop star who had just done her first movie. And it was premiering actually in the panorama section of the festival, which isn't part of the main competition. And we got this email that said, would you want to interview Madonna? So I interviewed Madonna. I will have to say I was a little nervous. So
I got to meet and interview Shirley MacLaine last night, which was the fulfillment of all of my youthful fantasies.
I interviewed Keira Knightley, and I don't remember a minute of it.
So we're going to wrap up here. So I'd like to just go down the line and like for each one of you to talk about not only what you're currently doing, which I want to know, but what your current passion is beyond the actual occupation that you're filling.
I'm currently a publicist, a journalist, a filmmaker, and I started a film and television finance company in Iceland on Friday. So I'm a little busy. My passion actually is regional filmmaking. It's small independent filmmakers making films in places like Virginia, where I live in Kentucky, and places taking advantage of individual states and their tax incentives and getting outside of your normal filmmaking areas. I think that's really exciting. I'm also really excited about VR, which we haven't talked about, but you know, if anybody's curious
virtual
about
reality.
What the next sort of evolution in storytelling technology is, virtual reality is, if you've ever go, I know they're having some stuff here, go put on the goggles, do the thing. You'll just, no matter what you think it is, it's better.
And then augmented reality, which is going to follow it and
right.
be even more mind tripping.
Yeah.
Brian?
I do work still actually with Eugene at the Film Society of Lincoln Center in New York. I program some areas of year-round programming there. I also write for Deadline Hollywood regularly, and then I'm also co-producing a television/episodic festival that happens in Denver in June called Series Fest. And I will have this, I mean, all those things I love. I actually still really love going to film festivals. I consider myself lucky that I get to do this, and I still do. I mean, I still love it. I mean, it's funny, I always get choked up when I say this, but I am forever amazed at filmmakers' bravery. And it makes me excited to see all these wonderful films. And I still, even after all these years, I still find it a wonderful thing. And I do feel very fortunate to be able to do that.
Yeah, just to add one thing is that you go to these festivals. We've been doing this for 20 years. Yesterday, I ran into someone who starred in a film that I produced, a short film in 1994. And I hadn't seen her since. And all of a sudden, she was standing next to me at a party. So that kind of crazy stuff just happens at film festivals, and it's magical.
Yeah. Eric?
Well, I'm a cat person. I am a cat person. We should start Catwire one day. BuzzFeed kind of did it first. No, it's funny. I have this double-headed title now at IndieWire as deputy editor and chief critic. I think it just kind of happened after being there for a while where I just do a lot of stuff. But the main thing that drives me in terms of doing it is being able to build out more interest in what I'm doing. And one of the reasons why I think we were as small as we were for a while, in addition to some things we were discussing, is because a lot of people didn't know the opportunities available to them. Eugene and I partnered up a couple years ago starting this workshop that we've done at a couple different film festivals, including New York, called the Critics Academy, which is a workshop for aspiring critics. And at this point, over 50 people have gone through it. Some of them have actual jobs doing this kind of work, not necessarily as film critics in the most traditional sense, but as people in the media world. And I've parlayed that into an adjunct position at NYU in the Cinema Studies Department, where I teach undergraduate film criticism. And I only screen contemporary work, and I have my students write about the contemporary film scene. Essentially, what I've been really driven by is education. For whatever the future of this community is, because I think it's just so essential to make people aware of the opportunities that are at their disposal right now, which are, you know, there are many of them.
That's great. Eugene?
I mean, I think I mentioned I work at the Film Society of Lincoln Center. I was thrilled and honored when our executive director, who's a filmmaker, Leslie Kleinberg, asked me to become the deputy director because it touches on a lot of things that have already been mentioned by everybody here on this group, and that is what drives me right now is kind of takes me back to where it was when we started, and that is finding, nurturing, supporting, embracing stories from as many different viewpoints and voices and worlds as possible, and that's what the Film Society tries to do. And also finding ways to nurture and support the next generation of both artists and critical voices. So the work we're doing, and I like to surround myself with people that I want to spend time with. So the programs that we're working on, the free talks that Brian curates for us at Film Society, the Critics Academy program that Eric mentions, our Industry Academy and Artist Academy programs at Lincoln Center, are really the most, and our new education program, are the most exciting things that I'm involved with, and I get to work with people like Leslie, like Eric, Brian. We got to figure out a way to get Mark involved on things that just, you know, it's such an important moment for all of us, as we all know, and the moment we're all in culturally and politically and socially, that the work we do can have a tremendous impact. But there's also so many voices out there that need to be nurtured and supported, so that their voice can be even louder, especially in this moment. No matter what happens on Tuesday, it'll be vital. And so that's something that I think we take very seriously as individuals. I know I do it in the position that I have, and I know it comes with tremendous responsibility, and it's something that we talk about a lot as well.
And a shout out to Virginia Film Festival and Virginia University for having such
University
a
of Virginia.
I'm sorry, University of Virginia.
Yeah, I've been very, very impressed by what everybody here is doing. It's been a fantastic time.
What each of you has done and what each of you is doing is important, it's vital, it matters. And Eugene, Eric, Brian, Mark, continue forth, because you're helping change our culture. Thank you for being here, and thank you guys.
Thank you,
thank you all for coming.